This podcast episode has a CC by SA 4.0 license. This license requires that reusers give credit to the creator. It allows reusers to distribute, remix, adapt, and build upon the material in any medium or format, even for commercial purposes. If others remix, adapt, or build upon the material, they must license the modified material under identical terms. Thank you.
Hello, okay. And welcome to the Permaculture CoLab podcasts. My name is Daniel Atwell. I work in the Permaculture CoLab on a number of projects, and I am the host for these podcast sessions where we explore grassroots permaculture projects, big and small. And today I have a special guest. Can you introduce yourself, please?
Hello, Daniel, and to the listeners of the podcast, my name is Figile Vilagazi. I am the president of Ikwelo Healers Collective in South Africa. We work in internationally. My ancestral name is Gogo Solomon Shabango. Namastogozan.
Well, to start, please, could you describe your project and what motivated you to be part of it, please?
Well, I mean, the project that we are running, currently is a permaculturist landless project. And the idea is to work with healers in South Africa and all over the world, where our reach is, to particularly in Southern Africa, to basically check what are the challenges that, traditional healers, indigenous healers have when it comes to accessing land for growing food and for growing medicines, particularly those of us who are working, from a permaculture perspective and way of life. So that's basically what motivated us to start this research. And I think one of the things is we were noticing, Daniel, that many of us have an intention to grow, and some of us are growing, but there are a number of barriers, right? There are a number of barriers in terms of just being able to either, be able to negotiate land in the villages, those of us who are living in the villages, and in the urban spaces, land just being not available. If it is available, it's just dilapidated, and it's not accessible for many reasons. One of the major reasons being issues of income. We are operating in a country where we're experiencing high levels of unemployment. So the kind of work that we're doing really comes from the heart. Many of us don't really have income for it. So we're checking all those things. How then are healers navigating that space of just being able to have land and grow food and medicines? And then we see how we can work with those barriers as a collective to make sure that as many of us as possible do have some kind of access to land to grow.
Great. Mm. And I know your project is quite new, but what research what information have you come up with so far?
Well, this project is part of a collective that we call Ikwelo Healers Collective. The collective itself started in 2020 during COVID-19. So we came together as a group of healers through that time to really just imagine ways in which our work can contribute towards healing, in the form of traditional medicines, indigenous medicines, but also food and nutrition, because food heals us, the kind of and the manner in which we grow food. We started realizing that consumption is really something that should be happening from a place of love. So growing the kind of food, from those kinds of ways where we have a particular relationship with the soil, a particular relationship with the earth, and of course, planting and growing with animals even and with Mother Nature. So it's not failing you in that sense. But what then has happened is that we realize that we don't know much about the challenge, experiences, let me put it that way, because there are positive experiences, but we didn't have much knowledge about how many of us actually have got access to land and are growing. And those of us who are growing, what could be some of the barriers to make sure that that work continues? And I think that was also because of the fact that South Africa, Daniel, as you may know, we come from a particular history of colonization and apartheid. You know, post-independence in Africa, a number of countries tried to continue in their own way, but in South Africa, we still had to deal with apartheid. And that has got some bearing from 1913, where the majority of people in the country were dispossessed from, you know, in terms of land. So some of the work that we're doing is linked directly to that, because this the status of dispossession and returning of land, or returning to the land that was dispossessed, is not really changed much in the last couple of years. I would say in the last 100 years. And so we wanted to know what is actually happening even during democracy, because in the last 30 years, since 1994, the government that came into power, or the different dispensation, you know, dispensations of the governments of democracies that we've had, have not really been able to change the landscape around accessibility to land, particularly for women, for healers, who, you know, and other bodies that are on the margin. And that is really what prompted us to ask these questions. And about last year, like 2 years and last year, we then said perhaps we need to do research, right? We need to do some kind of an inquiry that will lead us into finding those answers. And we then started formulating this proposal. And then, of course, one of our colleagues who led us into the space, which you may know, Vida, said, you know, maybe there are these opportunities in the CoLab space. And as you have been imagining it, as I'm saying to you, we are doing this work from love, really. There's no money in it. And it's not about money for us, luckily. So then we said, okay, let us utilize this opportunity to then think about how we can collect this information and collect this data, and to know amongst ourselves, but also generally amongst the population of healers in South Africa, and some of those of us who are on the African continent. And that is how it emerged, you know, and we put in that proposal through the work that is happening now in the emerging festivals. And I think we also thought about the diversity grant as well, to see if we can utilize just that to start that conversation of saying, even if it's desktop, but also having conversation with healers who are on the land, but also those who wish to be in the land and are not. What actually are the experiences, and what is the situation? And that is how we got into this work. And then, you know, and as we were writing this proposal, in fact, since 2020, Daniel, and listeners at home, we were very clear that ours is a different mandate. I mean, we are permaculturists. We, you know, we value the earth. We value the way that we make food and make medicines. So it's bound to be a unique project, at least in terms of where we are. Mainly because it's completely away from your capitalist arrangement of growing, you know, your neoliberal type of an approach when it comes to agribusiness, you know, growing food and medicine and agriculture. So we are a peculiar group of people in the country, indigenous communities in our country, and I'll say countries in Southern Africa, and perhaps also somewhere internationally, you know, from the healers that are part of us, have shown us that indigenous people continue to be a marginalized community. And I think we knew that. So this is what has informed us to say our journey is always going to be alternative, you know, for lack of a better word. Our journey is always going to be on the margins. And of course, our relationship with Mother Earth is also that of saying we don't want to interact with this work through extracting from earth and not retaining and not giving birth and giving back to earth as well. So that cycle is what really prompted us into this work. And we were very aware. I mean, we were looking in different spaces, and we could see that information does not exist. That knowledge, if it exists, it's hidden somewhere. And we then committed ourselves to saying we want to get to the depth of that, and talk to each other, and talk to those of us who have at least like-minded approaches and like-minded objectives, and it brought us here. Yeah.
Great, thank you. And I'm sure there are many like-minded people like yourselves, but how many do you think healers and It's rather a broad subject, but not a broad category. But the landless in South Africa, how many people do you think you would want to impact or do you represent?
Look, I mean, realistically speaking, we are not at this point able to say we can reach like thousands of people
Hmm.
through this work. We are starting from where we are. Ours is like to say, if we can get 10 healers at least to have access to land, 20 healers, 100 healers in the different provinces, because our country has got 9 provinces. And if you can get in each of those provinces about 5 healers that can access land, honest, because we believe that small is better, local is even better. If people can really be able to access land within their districts, even better. So we're anticipating, of course, currently we're a collective of about more than 100 people, and the majority of us are growers and are permaculturists. So we're hoping that through this work, already we are impacting, amongst those people. And you could literally not say all the 100 people are probably growing. A segment of us are definitely dedicated growers, or maybe half, 50% of that. So you could say at least at the end of this project, we'll be able to impact about 50 people. But what we are then hoping, Daniel, is that this work is just the beginning. It's not ending here. Through this work, we are hoping to produce, for instance, maybe a guide, or some kind of tools or framework that we can then use over time through conversation, through sharing of information, through knowledge transfer with many of us who may not have necessarily been able to reach here and come into these spaces because of data, because of lack of devices. Many healers in the villages that belong to the collective really can't even rise into a WhatsApp space. So we want to then, those of us who can, produce this information, and then we can share it in those ways, literally by doing groundwork, in the villages, and through those kinds of conversations and circles that we have, because we have smaller circles of spaces that all this work happens also at a ground level that is not necessarily on online. So that's what we're hoping, and through that, then we are likely to reach more than the 50 or 100 that is able to come to WhatsApp, but maybe more. In the next maybe 5 to 10 years, we see this work growing. Also, because we belong to another network, which is the Global Eco Village Network. So our work also sort of like links into that. In South Africa, we've got the chapter of the South African Global Eco Village Network that we are also a part of, and we are hoping through that network we can also reach to many healers and indigenous communities who are operating within that, but just also ordinary people who are not necessarily located in collectives, just ordinary healers who are not able to come and organize themselves in these ways, because that is our intention. Our intention is to say this work is for all of us. We all can share, in the resources that Mother Nature gives. We all should be able to share, on land. And the idea is that hopefully we can find ways of saying, even if you can't have your own piece of land, but we are hoping to find some information and guide in this research to see how communal land sharing could be an option, for instance, for people who are not able to have accessibility on their own, given the barriers that we are likely to identify in this research. One of them we anticipate will be lack of money, maybe, it could be also, issues of unemployment and not just being able to purchase land and so on. So we're hoping that we can be able to do that kind of work with the outcomes of this research and reach as much as possible.
So please speak about some of the barriers and other things that stop people from accessing land at the moment.
One of them is money, as I've indicated. We are living in a new liberal country. A lot of things that we used to get for free have been privatized. I can tell you, as healers, there are forests, for instance, and just nature spaces that we are not able to get into anymore because now they are owned by private businesses. So money, capital is a big issue. The fact that now you have to buy land, when we never really used to buy land, you could literally go to a chief and you say, "Can you, cut this portion for me to be able to or indigenous leader, it could be a queen as well, but those spaces are shrinking. So capital is a big challenge. And in other communities, like in villages, you could still be able to go to your chief or your queen, but that in itself also acts as a barrier in that, the chiefs in South Africa, in this democracy, it happened also during apartheid, have been positioned as custodians of the land. So land ownership in the country currently is in the hands of chiefs, or in the hands of municipalities. So if you then want to have land, you need to be able to negotiate those spaces. But what we are finding is that the kings and the chiefs and the queens tend to think that that land belongs to them, traditional leadership, to the exclusion of other people. They would give it to their families, their descendants, and so on. And what has now even happened is that that land was meant to be given to people for free to be able to live, for livelihoods. But now people are being asked to pay lease, in those kinds of spaces. So again, posing a barrier in terms of accessibility because people just don't have money to pay for lease. And then there's issues of gender, Daniel. In some places like Eswatini, for instance, which is another country in Southern Africa, which is actually still a monarchy. I think it's one of the surviving monarchies on the African continent. People still, women still need to have a husband sign off for them to be able to access land. And now that's a barrier for many, many women to be able to just have access to land, not even to own it. If you don't have a husband, if you're not married, then it means basically that you are not going to be able to have access to land. So you're treated as an infant permanently in some jurisdictions because of culture, because of tradition, and that then, and mothers continue to be caregivers in our societies, indigenous communities generally. And if you don't have access to land, it means you're not able to grow food, you're not able to grow medicine. And unless your husband gives you permission to do that. So those are some of the barriers also that are still shockingly so during democracy are still happening in our country. The relationship between democratic governance and traditional leadership has not really sorted itself in a manner that enables accessibility in terms of rights to land for certain bodies. So those are some of the barriers that I think those are some of the key barriers that I could say. And I mean, thirdly, it's just the issue of decolonization and systems of oppression that we have experienced in the past. And the entrance to colonization was dispossession of a people in terms of land, right? When the colonizers arrived on our shores in 1652, the first thing that was taken away from people was land. And you can then fast forward to that, to the 1800s, to the 1900s, with all the wars that have happened. It has really been about territory. It has been about land. So a majority of people continue to be dispossessed over time, through wars, through different leaders that have come. You will remember, I don't know if you know the story, but in South Africa, we had the arrival of Jan van Riebeck, who removed the Khoi people from land, Khoi and the San, indigenous communities from land. And then there was the arrival of the British, who fought with the Netherlands, with the Afrikaners, amongst themselves, also fighting for land. In that process, the majority of Black people continued to be deeply dispossessed, and deeply being moved away from land. And that story did not change. During democracy, even the new government that has come into power, instead of reversing the system, they in fact developed an elite of people who then, democratic leaders themselves came closer to the benefits of the land, whether it is about mining, whether it is about getting access and proximity to minerals on the soil, to gold and copper and all those things, and forgot about the people. So that's a biggest barrier. The fact that the colonial is still with us, right? In different bodies, even in the bodies of people who fought for freedom, by the way, for indigenous communities. Those people attempted, as soon as they rise into power, they are just really drawn into greed. They are drawn into corruption. And they lose those values of care, those values of love, those values of community, a sense of respect, even for Mother Earth. People just look at nature as something that you just need to take from, and make money from. So I think that's one of also, thirdly, the biggest barriers, the fact that the colonial is still with us. We are really subjected in, through the coloniality of power. That sits even in the bodies of leaders that we're supposed to be trusting, but we're not able to trust, which is why the collective was actually formed. Because part of it, we realized that political systems, in the manner that they are arranged at this point, Daniel, are not able to free us and reorganize our relationship with Mother Earth, that we have to do it ourselves, even if we do it in smaller scales and smaller ways wherever we are. And we will continue to defend that relationship with Mother Earth, to heal ourselves and to heal our loved ones and our families and the communities around us. And I think if it's something that we have to do for as long as we're here on Earth, that's something that we're going to do. And that's Yeah, those are some of the barriers. There's much I can say, but I'll stop here for now. So, just to highlight those three.
Something interesting you mentioned that the having access to forests and private land obviously is very difficult, but there are some possibly large areas of national parks that possibly are in public ownership. And I'm interested, is there legislation within the national park to allow access by Indigenous people to the land or the medicines within that national park, for example?
You can access it, but you can't do anything. Like parks, for instance, parks have been converted into like botanical gardens. We have a thing like that, but still, to go in there, you have to pay. So it's highly privatized. It's owned by certain people. I'll tell you a story. I mean, during COVID-19, I don't know if you know, there's a herb that we're using here to treat fever called Umhlonyane. Is Artemisia afra. I think the Chinese also use it. It's quite popular. Artemisia afra in our language is called Umhlonyane. As healers, you could literally just cross the road, go to a forest, and harvest Umhlonyane, to be able to do treatment, to do concoctions, to be able to treat different fevers. So we wanted to use it during COVID, but we were also sharing it with our governments to say, we know of herbs, not just that one, many others. We've been using, our grandmothers, our great parents have been using it for generations, that can heal us, because COVID is just like another fever. As soon as they realized that, Daniel, as soon as they realized that, they actually stopped us from harvesting it. They stopped us from actually accessing the forests. And it's not just that's the one an anecdote. There are many other examples I can tell you. So that is the kind of a thing that then they start to protect the selected natural plants, for certain people and not necessarily for the community. And they start to commercialize them for their own benefit, and they start exporting them, and that becomes that relationship of trade between countries, between governments. But who benefits from those relationships? You and me will know. We have the same experience here. It is the politicians, it is big business, it is influential individuals, not necessarily communities on the ground. And there are many stories. In South Africa, we have a very popular story that the world is familiar with, the story of the koi and the sun and the plant that you call hoodia. That our great grandparents have survived on that plant in the forest, to quench thirst, to quench hunger. When you go hunting, the hunter gatherers actually lived on that plant. And they started to expropriate. expropriate that plant. You talk about rooibos tea. Rooibos tea also is grown here by the Khoi and the San people, and there's many others I can mention. So those kinds of things, as soon as they realize, they just take things away from the people. So even if it's on parks, there are a number of medicines that are on areas now that have been designated as municipal parks or district parks or provincial parks. They are earmarked as heritage sites by government and protected species. But they're not necessarily protected because they're actually being targeted by neoliberalists, for their own benefit. And that's how it is, unfortunately. Healers, yeah, being arrested. Healers during COVID-19 were being arrested for just wanting to go to the forest and access a plant to heal. And people are being arrested for growing food in their backyards. If you talk about urban gardening, some one person grew cabbages outside of their pavement, their yard. They were arrested to say, "Why do you grow cabbages outside of your yard?" And cabbage is such an amazing antioxidant. And if you can get food on your doorstep, why not? Why do you arrest people who grow food? Why don't you arrest criminals? So that's the kind of thing that is happening here, on a larger scale. It's quite disheartening, but we have chosen that our path is going to be a positive one. We are going to just stay on the path of growing and finding spaces and utilizing spaces for purposes of regeneration of the natural environment for purposes of healing. Yeah,
And
and we'll do it from the place of love. Yeah.
yeah, good. And you are succeeding. And you said you have your maybe you have 50 people by the end of the project into land for healers and the landless. But what kind of land? Where is this land? And how do you collectivize it?
Well, we have land in villages, and now these are like traditional spaces, and I'm using the word traditionally selectively. But you have got rural, let me call it rural. You've got because we've got a our country is structured, we've got a rural divide, rural and urban divide, and then you've got like your semi-rural spaces. So there's a lot of land in the villages, which is mostly your rural communities that you will find. And then you also find land in urban spaces. It's like when someone, has a house, or whether it is a communal municipal space. Got a lot of abandoned buildings, which our research is focusing on, for instance, because we see that as land, abandoned urban spaces, where, for instance, maybe there was a building that was put in there or a structure. A lot of people are converting those structures into gardens, into medicinal gardens and food gardens, permaculture, using permaculture principles, of course. And then you're also finding land in semi, what I would call semi-rural, semi-urban spaces. This is now people who are living in flats. Maybe they've migrated into those spaces. What we have started to do is to say, wherever you are, you can grow. Even if you're in a flat, in the rooftop, you can actually put a garden there and be able to grow your food in there, so that you don't have to necessarily go and buy your vegetables and your medicines at ShopRite, Checkers, or Woolworths, but you can literally eat from your own garden and share with your neighbors, So that's the kind of landscape that we have. But most of our food, of course, is grown in rural village spaces, because there's massive land space, like flat land where you can grow food, and then it gets transported into the different provinces. Even medicine as well come from those rural communities. There's about three of them. We've got nine provinces, about three of them, which is the Eastern Cape, KwaZulu-Natal, and Limpopo, which mainly are our source of growing, in the provinces. But I mean, that land is in the hands of the few. And that's the biggest deal for us, to say, why not, don't you make land accessible to the majority of the people, so that as much as possible, people can work from home and eat from home and heal from home as well and share with the neighbors and communities. But that's how the landscape is like.
So if the villages actually hold land collectively, is that then under the legislation of the village elder or the chiefs, sorry, the chiefs? Or does each person of the village have a plot of land they can use for their own?
Some people have their own plots, yes. They buy it from the chief. You no longer get it for free. So you could go to a chief and say, I really would like a piece of land to live with my family, to grow food and so on. Then they will cut you that piece of land, and then you have to pay X amount of money in that land. Most of it, in fact, in rural areas at this point, because of the neoliberal system, is no longer communal. People own it for themselves. But you still do find communal gardens, that are facilitated directly by the municipality or by just individuals who come together in communities who say, we want to, in our community, we want to start a community garden, we want to grow our own food, and then we can share and exchange with each other. But those are minimal, those are very minimal, and that's the kind of thing that we are promoting to say, let us go back to the principles and values of sharing. The more communal the space, the more all of us can have access, and try to move away from the principles of individuality to say, this is mine, I own it, to the exclusion of others. But that is what is happening. But you're also finding it, especially women. Women are really working together. You have co collectives, you have cooperatives. We have been working with this model of cooperatives a lot during democracy in the last 30 years. Some of them have not really been successful because of challenges I've already highlighted around money and so on. And it's also very difficult to register collectives in the country. But people are doing that work, whether they are registered or not registered, just coming together, working as collectives and growing food together, and making livelihoods together, being able to at least, if someone is growing cabbages and the other one is growing aloo and the other one is growing umhlonyane, then you are able to do that chain of sharing amongst one another, who needs what. So that is the model at this point that you'll find in most of the villages. So it's a mix. We have a hybrid system. Those who can afford, like most of the middle class, are able to then buy a plot for themselves. But the majority of people who can afford are still highly dependent on communal land, which is very difficult to negotiate because of what I've indicated. You have to go through the chiefs. But most of it, Daniel, is sitting in the hands of chiefs. And their families are sitting within kingdoms and queendoms. In Limpopo, we've got the queendom of the Mujajis. They have land, they get budget from the state. In KwaZulu-Natal, we've got the Zulu kingdom. You may have heard about the Zulu kingdom from Inkosi uShaka, or King Shaka. It's still in existence. They also are custodians of KwaZulu-Natal land, and they get budget from the state to be able to mark. It's never really shared with the people as it should be shared with the people. In the Eastern Cape, the same. You've got your Abatembu. I can mention a number of kingdoms and queendoms that we've got here, indigenous communities. You have the Khoi and the San people as well, who still continue to fight for their accessibility to land. So even if it's there, it is still owned by the former colonizers in majority. Massive piece of land, massive pieces of land are still in the hands of the descendants of Jan van Riebeck, and they're still in the hands of the descendants of the British. So you find that the majority of people who still own land here have converted that land into business opportunities, massive, massive businesses. Are white British residents and white Afrikaans residents, and that is where I say we have not really fully decolonized ourselves, and neither have we truly freed ourselves from the system of apartheid, economically speaking, because land is economy, land is livelihood. Yeah, the majority of people continue to what's the word to negotiate like squashed pieces of land, like very small pieces of land, squatting and overcrowded spaces, high levels of informal settlements here. People literally grow in the back of their informal settlements because of that, and that's the biggest part of. But land is here, is available. We have massive land in, even in Southern Africa generally, not just us. I think it's just to change the ways and the values of doing things. And for ours, really, permaculture is the way to go. We firmly believe that if we take the route of permaculture, our relationship with land can change, and permaculture livelihoods are possible, and we can all share. There's massive resources from earth. We can all live together and share. No one will ever go hungry if we stop greed, you know.
Thank you very much for introducing your project. I wish you all the best in the future. Thank you for joining us for this podcast.
Thank you so much for inviting us. Thank you, Daniel.